This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Why does the American network Fox News use every snowstorm to deny the world is warming? Chris Mooney is author of four books, including The Republican War on Science. He's a widely published science writer, appears on TV, and helps educate scientists on how to communicate better. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I recorded this speech by Chris Mooney at the annual meeting of the AAAS, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, in Vancouver, February 19, 2012. You'll also get a sneak peek into his new book. This is Chris Mooney in an event titled Climate Solutions, the Challenges of Getting to 350.
Thank you for including me. It's an honor to be on a panel with Jim Hansen, obviously one of our heroes in climate communication. So in addressing this massive problem of how do we get the climate system back in the safe zone, I've been called upon to focus on the issue of science communication and also the problem of science denial. And to understand both of these, first you have to think about science denial as not being very different from the denial of reality in general. And that's why I use this. And second, I'm going to contend that to really get what's going on here, you have to understand the politically conservative psychological processes we're dealing with and what is driving them. So my chief argument, which I'll elaborate on in the next 20 minutes, is that to get our communications right and to understand, just to understand our current state of dysfunction, fiddling while the planet burns, we have to advance two scientific projects. One, the science of science communication. And two, the science of the left, the right, and the denial of reality. And we've made some progress in both areas, but there is a long way yet to go. Another way of framing the issue is, how do you explain this? Fox News, how do you explain it? What is it? It uses every new snowstorm as an excuse to sow doubt about global warming. And Fox News viewers have been shown in repeated studies to be more misinformed. Fox News increases your risk of being wrong about global warming. All right? How could that be? How could this exist? My contention is we can't understand such a phenomenon without looking at the deepest psychological motivations behind climate denial behavior as epitomized on Fox News. And that also is going to include looking at our own motivations and why they are so different from theirs. We have to understand ourselves, too. I'm going to be previewing information from my latest book in this. It's called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And it's controversial. So I've actually linked on my blog, scienceprogressaction.org/intersection, 18 published peer-reviewed studies showing differences between liberals and conservatives. You can go read them if you don't believe me. I'm actually reporting on mainstream research, but it's controversial. I used to misunderstand political conservatives and why they deny reality. I wrote a book about it. It wasn't wrong, but it didn't see everything. And this was 7 years ago now, and I've been learning a lot more ever since then. I approached communicating on this topic originally like a scientist does, you know, in the old Enlightenment mode. I went on tour, and I was going to explain, they're wrong about science. They're misrepresenting science. Here's what the scientists say. I've interviewed them. Here are the facts, and here are the misrepresentations, and here's why it's wrong. Do you think that this convinced conservatives? Why did I think it would? But I wasn't speaking to audiences of conservatives, was I? I was speaking to audiences like you. And I didn't think then also about why my audiences would be so self-selected. But my manner of communicating to them had a predictable effect. It made you angry. It made you really upset at all this misinformation in public life, all these crimes against science in your own government. This was the Bush administration. At the end of the talk, all of your hands would go up and you'd say, oh, what can I do? You've made me very angry, Chris. You've made me want to punch a wall about all this bad science and science abuse and denial. What can I do about the problem? And I realized my instinctual answer to that question, which was, you can go buy my book, which not enough, not adequate. And so the next 7 years are really a variety of ways of thinking about understanding what's really going on here. And that's led to a lot of efforts. One of them is pushing scientists to communicate better, right? And I think we can all agree that that's important, and I've actually been involved in actively training them to communicate. This is a picture from one of our NSF science communication trainings at Mississippi State. We've done almost a dozen now across the country. We've trained over 1,000 scientists. I think we're getting good at this. I'm very proud of it. But as time passed, you know, that wasn't enough either, I think. I couldn't fail to notice that the problem of denying science, denying reality in America was not getting better. It is getting worse. Global warming denial, which is our chief focus here, has gotten more monolithic on the political right as the science has gotten more clearly defined, more solid, and the crisis more urgent. Paradoxically, or maybe not paradoxically, if we really understand what we're dealing with. But how could something like that happen? Well, here are my answers on both of these fronts, and I'm going to use a wordy slide, okay? Because I know you guys like wordy slides. One, the communication war within science is mostly over. The good guys won, okay? We don't have to fight anymore about it. But we have not reached the public. So from now on, if we're going to be effective, science communication has to be rooted in the science of science communication, to quote Yale's Dan Kahan. One of the revelations from the science of science communication is the scientific evidence shows that scientific evidence alone is rarely sufficient to change minds. You must accept this, QED. The evidence also shows that liberals and conservatives are just different people, and scientists are mostly psychological liberals. You therefore cannot trust your instincts in communication. They are wrong. What you think you're doing is not right. Well, maybe some of you have gotten past that, but the instinct is not right. The great strength of scientists is their willingness to listen to evidence and change their ways. That's what you have to go on. So let's get moving and, paradoxically, let's stay the course. So start with the good news. The communication war within science is mostly over. The good guys won. What do I mean by that? It used to be that when people like me would try to rally scientists to be better communicators, we'd get all this blowback. We would hear, that's not our job. It's the job of you journalists. Why are you trying to give us one extra thing to do? We teach. We do research, we apply for grants, and now you want us to communicate as well. And people would remember the story of Carl Sagan and how he actually was attacked by his colleagues for being such a good communicator. There were even attacks on the scientific research showing that things like framing work, okay? It's kind of obvious, but this was controversial. The idea that we should frame scientific information because it would go down easier for some audiences was controversial in 2007. But within a short period of time, and this is why I love you guys, you looked at the evidence, you changed your mind, and all of this is now pretty accepted, and everybody wants to be what we call at NSF a deadly ninja of science communication. You're all into it. Minds have changed extraordinarily fast, and that's a good thing. We still get some resistance to this idea of more scientific communication and outreach. We still get negativity on scientists using social media and blogging. They're afraid somehow that they're going to spend the rest of their days in front of a screen wearing only their underwear, playing whack-a-mole, you know, with science deniers. But we're going to pass that hurdle, too. They're going to eventually accept those skills, too. We've come a long way in a short time in this science communication endeavor. But so far, the science communication outreach endeavor, at least that I'm a part of, and I think I speak for a lot of the science communication training that's going on, is largely focused on what I would call the practical, the how-to. And that includes things like, you know, teaching scientists how to design a message in a strategic way, not to data dump, not to go on too long. Jargon busting. You cannot use words that your audience does not understand. You may not. It's not allowed. Hey, you should know what audience you're talking to, what they think, what their views are, or else your message won't get through. All this basic stuff. You should know what journalists are like, how they like to be approached, how they don't like to be approached. So we filled 2 days with this. It's just the beginning. And to tackle science communication with the public on the most contested scientific issue of today, climate change, there's so much more. This is just a very, very simple baseline. More specifically, we have to merge this practical how-to kind of stuff with the theory of science communication and the science of science communication. And that means what we're starting to learn from the social sciences about what motivates and drives people, including what drives them toward science resistance. And that leads to my second point. From now on, science communication strategies must be rooted in the science of science communication. And that's to quote Yale's Dan Kahan, who came up with that phrase. And a lot of his research is central to the science of science communication. So what does it show? Start with a simple study showing the effectiveness, of framing. Okay, so this is the same fake newspaper article containing the facts about global warming. It's caused by humans, happening now. Scientists have a consensus about this. Framed, and this is the experimental manipulation, two different headlines. Scientific panel recommends nuclear solution to global warming. Scientific panel recommends anti-pollution solution to global warming. This study just showed, by Kahan, that if you play this framing game and you get political conservatives, then they reject the facts much more in the anti-pollution frame than they reject the facts in the nuclear power frame. Okay? So that opens their mind, that closes their mind. Very simple, but this is the kind of thing that has to be always in mind as we try to reach the public. And it's just the beginning. This is the overarching framework that Kahan uses in order to explain this. He divides up people based upon two different ways in which they have different views about politics, two axes. One is how hierarchical are you? In other words, how much do you support various kinds of inequality based on class, race, gender, what have you, versus how egalitarian you are? And then how individualistic are you? How much do you think you should be able to go it alone without government getting in your way versus how communitarian you are? How much you think it takes a village and we're all in it together and government needs to protect? Republicans tend to live up here. Democrats tend to live down here. Of course, there are exceptions, but generally conservatives, Republicans are hierarchically individualistic, and liberals or Democrats are more communitarian and egalitarian. All right, so what does this do? What does this do to people? In one study he performed, he created a fake scientific expert who said that global had good credentials, National Academy of Sciences member and all the rest, who said global warming is caused by humans, and they gave him a paragraph explaining why this is so. So if you live in the top left, then 23% of you think that that is a scientific expert. But if you live in the bottom right, 88% of you think it's a scientific expert. In other words, science for many of us is whatever we want it to be, whatever supports our worldview. The worldview comes first, and then we determine expertise itself on that basis. So the facts do not change minds. Shifting cultural meanings and understandings shape acceptance of facts. That's how it works, which leads to point three. The scientific evidence shows that scientific evidence is rarely sufficient to change minds. Okay, that's just the beginning of the evidence demonstrating that. And to further demonstrate it, I want to give you something that drives you absolutely mad, but it's hard to resist. And this is the concept that a lot of people are what I call smart idiots. Okay? Sounds oxymoronic, maybe not so much. In other words, the more they know about something, the more they learn, the more they research, or the more educated they are, what have you, the more biased they become. And if they're biased in the wrong direction, the more wrong they become. Which goes in precisely the opposite way of what we think if we think the Enlightenment is a good thing and we have to give people facts in order to make them understand and believe and accept. That's what we all want to believe. Let me tell you how I learned about the smart idiot. It was this Pew data, 2008, and this is now in all over the social science literature on global warming, showing the relationship between political party affiliation, views about global warming, and level of education. And so what it shows is that if you're a Republican, then the higher level of education, the less likely you are to accept scientific reality. Okay? But if you're a Democrat or independent, the higher your level of education is, the more likely you are to accept scientific reality. This is not just a conservative thing. What you get on vaccine denial is the same thing. The parents who believe that vaccines cause autism, they tend to have a higher level of education. They tend to be better off. They tend to empower themselves and go research the issue on the internet. And that's how they end up being so wrong. It also shows up in non-political areas. So this is data from John Sides of George Washington. Increased belief that President Obama is a Muslim. It grew between March 2009 to August 2010. Who did it grow among? Well, not just Republicans, but if you had some college or you were a college grad and you were a Republican, then the belief increased much more than if you had high school or less. And so when you get to something, you just have to say, like, what is going on with these people? But seriously, what's going on? The more capable you are of coming up with arguments to support your beliefs, the more you'll think you're right and the more you'll think you're clever and ingenious, and the less likely you will be to change. You'll come up with all kinds of new ways of reaffirming yourself. This is emotionally satisfying. And you're laying down pathways in your brain that you'll use again and again and again. It gets even worse. Right? Because correcting people who believe wrong things also doesn't work a lot of the time. It doesn't stop them from being smart idiots. Another study of this, Brendan Nyhan, a political scientist at Dartmouth, he gave them fake newspaper articles that contained a wrong fact and then a correction of it. Okay, the wrong fact was Iraq has weapons of mass destruction or tax cuts increase government revenue. And he put these things in the mouth of George W. Bush, which was why he got the result that he did. Okay, so what happens if you give someone who believes these things the fact and then you correct it, and then you see what they think? Have you guys seen Swingers? Somebody's seen. What happens if you get 11 in blackjack? You double down. That's what they do once the belief is refuted. They double down, and they believe it even more strongly. Now, these kinds of denial are clearly political. Political values are getting in the way of people accepting what's true, and they're proving way more powerful than the information that you guys work so hard to create. Much of this is happening at a subconscious level. People don't even know they're doing it. They're just doing it. But it's not just values or morals or views of how society should be structured, as in Kahan's research. It's very important that it's not just that, though, that drives the kind of differential responses we see in the acceptance or rejection of science. There's something even deeper that makes us unable to understand each other and that drives the fight over what's true. That leads to point four. The evidence shows that liberals and conservatives are just different people, and most scientists are psychological liberals. When you get down to it, we think about ideology all wrong. We have a blank slate view. There are these two opposing philosophies, and people reach their views for intellectual reasons and thinking about the issues, and then they just think about them differently. That's not what ideology is at all. It is much more deeply rooted than that. All of the research suggests this. If our differences were purely the result of thinking rationally about the issues, okay, then why would differences between liberals and conservatives show up in how they organize their bedrooms? But they do. Liberals are messier. Conservatives are cleaner. Liberals have more books and magazines and travel guides and albums, and conservatives have, like, ironing boards and American flags, okay? And why would, this is all peer-reviewed research, right? Why would it show up in preferences for different kinds of art, with liberals liking abstract art more? Why would the two groups have different senses of humor? But they do, and there is actually a study about liberals and conservatives and how they view Colbert, and both think he's funny, but liberals think he's funny because they think he is a satire of conservatives, and conservatives think he's funny because he really agrees with them. I'm not joking, okay? This is what ideology is. It is much more than political views. And the differences go on and on. A scientist I work with for part of the book, a political scientist named Everett Young, found in his research, conservatives are more likely than liberals to think the fans of rival sports teams are less likable people. They're more likely to want to keep germs out of their bodies. And they're more likely to elect a candidate to Congress who keeps his lawn neatly edged. So where do these differences live? Somewhere in the brain. And believe it or not, there are brain studies that show some differences. I want to be very cautious about this. This is actually a study that was commissioned by the British actor Colin Firth, got into the scientific literature, but he asked for the study to be done because he said he wanted to figure out what was biologically wrong with the people who disagreed with him. Right? We don't want to go down that road, really, but that's actually what he said. And then he said, and believe it or not, they found something. Okay, they found, you know, somewhat more likely to have a larger right amygdala if you're conservative, and somewhat more likely to have more gray matter in the anterior cingulate if you're liberal, and this is all statistically significant. What does it mean? That's the issue, all right? I think we have to be very cautious with this kind of stuff. But we don't have to be cautious about is the research, the endless bodies of research that shows that personality is politics. And this is where the left-right differences are, I think, really hard to argue with. And this is probably the most important figure I'll show you. This is a Yale study, Yale political scientists. There's the reference, 12,000 people figuring out how personality correlates with ideology. And what you got here is on the top, you got things that make you more likely to be liberal, and the bottom, things that make you more likely to be conservative. And you've got the five, big five personality traits, I'll tell you what they are, and then you got a comparison with level of income, level of education. All right, it's widely known, this is a sociological reality, more income makes you conservative, more education makes you liberal. So that's on there. But what it shows is that personality can be at least as big, and conscientiousness, which is liking order and structure and regularity, pushes you conservative. Openness, which is liking new ideas and trying new things, pushes you way liberal. Agreeableness is kind of split. Stability, which is the opposite of neuroticism, is more conservative. Extroversion, conservatives have more friends. So, what makes you liberal? Openness and education. What makes you conservative? Money and structure. Why do we disagree about reality? A lot of it's right here, lack of openness. Why do we view the world so differently than conservatives in this room? A lot of it's right here, education. This is what I think is really underlying things like the inability to accept what's true about global warming and the huge partisan gulf on the matter. And the implications of this are huge, not just for our intellectual adversaries, but for ourselves and how we think about things. We think about things in an ivory tower way. You know, there's this statistic, AAAS members, 2009, Pew study, 6% Republicans. And someone said, oh, well, we need more Republican scientists. I'm like, wait, no, this is kind of the way it works. Scientists are liberal because they have the openness and they're all interested in trying new things and figure out new ideas. They don't have a need for certainty and they're okay with nuance and they're okay with not knowing and they constantly got to change something. They're pushed in the same way that liberals are pushed. And so, of course, they love living in the academic world because this is like a playground for people who are open to experience, open to new ideas. And of course, liberals have way more percentage of advanced degrees than conservatives do. This is a quote from a sociologist who studies it, just talking about how predominant the higher education difference is getting in dividing the left and the right. So we all know academia is liberal. We all know scientists are liberal. And now we know why, which leads to my fifth point. You cannot trust your instincts in communication. They are wrong because you're coming from this world. And your instincts are going to push you in the wrong direction, at least as soon as you try to communicate outside of that world. What instincts do we share from being in academia and being in science? Enlightenment instincts. The idea that you put the facts out there and everyone will debate them and we'll figure out what's true and what's false, and then we will make societal decisions and we will change for the better based upon the information. These assumptions are not universal, and in assuming that they are and in acting as if they are, we hobble ourselves in communication. Think about Fox News. Are they pursuing enlightenment assumptions, or are they exploratory in their ideology the way those who are open to experience are, or are they defensive in their ideology? And when they are attacking global warming, is it because to accept it would be too hard? They're not trying to find out, you know, what the next study says and what the next study says in order to get as close as they can to reality. They're sowing doubt because the reality is something that really, really deep down threatens them and threatens who they are and how they view society and how it should be structured. And we can rant about this and we can get angry about it, but if we want to understand it, I think that's the context in which we have to think about it. Is there good news? My sixth point. Our great strength, scientists' great strength, and liberals' great strength. I know not every scientist is a liberal, but the correlation is strong. The willingness to listen to evidence and change their ways. After all, this is openness to experience. Let's do something a little different. Well, let's do that in communication. These are some slogans that appeal to people who are open to experience. This is why you pay too much money for Mac computers, okay? But you're willing to do things differently. You're willing to change. So in communication, what is that going to mean? Let's get moving on doing things differently. We need to integrate the practical side of communication, the how-tos that I talked about before, with what the theory is starting to teach us about why people deny facts that are inconvenient, why liberals and conservatives are different. And then we need to apply that in the toughest areas, like climate. And we have to recognize that the future of science communication is going to lie in psychology and neuroscience. And we have to be ready for that. It's going to lie in figuring out precisely what kinds of narratives excite what kinds of emotions leading to what kinds of actions. And we're going to be able to study all of this, and we're going to be able to capture it. But the psychology research also, of course, shows that it's going to be so hard. I mean, let's be honest about it. Not only do we have to get moving, we have to do something even more difficult than that, which is stay the course once we get moving. Because a lot of what we know about people who deny things like climate science suggests that they bolted the hatches down, all right? The issues are too political, too polarized. Getting easy progress is going to be extremely hard, but that doesn't mean we can't try to better ourselves, those of us who are willing to change. And because we're committed to trying new things and adjusting what we do based upon what's true, we need to realize a weakness that we have, which is we're always disagreeing with each other. We're always squabbling. We're always, you know, being contrary, attacking our colleagues, because we're trying to say, over here, I'm different. I've got a different idea. Okay, 1,000 flowers bloom. This leads to political ineffectiveness. And that's one thing to keep in mind. In his latest book, Hockey Stick and the Climate War, as I'll end on this note, Mike Mann draws an analogy. He talks about being in the Serengeti, and he talks about the strategy that zebras employ to prevent lions from killing them off one by one. And that is, they all stand together, so you can't tell which one the weak one is in the pack. And what Mann says is that that's exactly what is needed in climate communication since it's become such a war. It's the opposite of what comes naturally because of openness, because of the academic background. And maybe that's the problem, is learning to hold together, hold the course. That might be the most important, but also the hardest and most counterintuitive thing of all. Thanks.
That was science writer Chris Mooney speaking to the AAAS conference in Vancouver 2012. The first question is he just talking about anti-science in America? And what about the moderates? Should we even be calling it climate change if so many people fear change?
Do I think this is too U.S.-centric? No. There are definitely cultural variations in ideology. I mean, obviously. But actually, left-right appears all over the place. And the psychology research has been done on left-right all over everywhere it appears. and it's consistent. Okay, so despite the cultural variability, you actually find the signal still in if you look at European left-right, for example. And there's a lot of published studies that show that. I mean, left and right is rooted in psychology, is what I'm saying, at least partly. And so it keeps showing up. So these things are a spectrum, right? Obviously, there's a left-right spectrum, and even that is a little simplified to understand ideology, but it does capture a lot of the variability. So on the spectrum, you have independents and you have moderates, and they're not exactly the same thing. Because there's a lot of evidence that shows that openness to experience makes you more likely to be liberal and independent because you want to be different. The moderates who really fall in the middle, I think, are probably often a psychological blend. Open, but not extremely open. Conscientious, not extremely conscientious. So I think you might see a psychological continuum just like you see, to some extent, just like you see a political continuum. But yeah, those people are going to be more reachable. And one of the things about being in the middle is that you have to look at left and right. I mean, it's kind of the nature of it. So that means you have to kind of integrate. And integrative complexity is one of the traits that leads people to be more compromising. Another one of the psychological traits, it's more on the left than the right, seeing different points of view. So in that sense, it's absolutely true that they should be more open. But you also have the problem of a lot of moderates and being just disengaged. And they actually might be psychological liberals or psychological conservatives, but they don't even know it because they don't know anything about the issues. And their emotions haven't connected to the issues. So once they actually connect and get informed, they might turn out to be radical on one side or the other. And so a lot of the electorate's like that. Right. So right now, the issue is pushing that individualistic button, which is a moral button. And it's not lining up with this whole we need to preserve stability and traditional culture and America as we've always known it, as the founding fathers wanted it, which is the sort of the anti-change, which actually has got a lot of positive aspects to it. At least it's a very successful message for conservatives when they talk about it that way. They're totally not fitting climate change into that mold. So why? Well, I mean, they've been told that it's not that. They've been told by all of the voices that they listen to that it is a threat to the individualistic value. So you have to get past that gigantic hurdle, which is incredibly emotional. And then, is there a possibility of reframing it? Well, I think when you look at the Pentagon caring about global warming, they're definitely trying to preserve stability, right? And they're not usually thought of as a liberal group. But they find it so destabilizing, and they're actually looking at the evidence, that they're like, we've got to do something. We've got to head this off. There's potential there. But the cultural meanings that exist now are so, it's been framed in a way that riles the individualistic right up so much that you would have to somehow like get them to drop that. And you can't because you can't control the information they're getting from Fox and everyone else. So that's the real difficulty there.
That was author and science journalist Chris Mooney, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at the AAAS Science Conference in Vancouver, Canada, February 19, 2012. Find more links to Chris's blog and research in my blog at ecoshock.info. I recorded about 19 presentations at the event, sometimes with two recorders going at one time. I'll play you more cutting-edge discoveries about our world in upcoming EcoShock shows. Others require new interviews with key scientists. New information with serious implications is coming in so fast, we all need to privately educate ourselves, just to understand how nature works, what we are allowed and not allowed to do, what we can't get away with, and what we can do to preserve a livable world for our kids and for our grandchildren and descendants. I'm Alex Smith. Visit our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening and caring about your world.